The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
But I'll tell you what, in a world of chaos, defined by increased capital controls, to me, gold makes an enormous amount of sense. Price be damned. I don't care if the price goes up or down in the next 2 weeks. It's a real financial asset. It is outside of the financial system. And I tell you what, those merits are going to add premium in time.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, if there were 100 people in the room right now and we were to ask how many of you are bullish on gold, six of them would raise their hand. Now, the markets, they're not giving us any encouragement right now. Can you address right off the bat the gold market since you talk so much about it?
Well, I mean, I know it seems kind of counterintuitive. When the sentiment is this negative, how can you say anything positive about the gold market? But that's exactly the point. The way markets trade, regardless of the asset in question, is when everyone is very, very excited about something, right, it's generally the time frame when you should not be excited. And when everyone is at peak pessimism, the point at which you just say, well, nothing good can happen, that's generally the point at which you should be very interested, because prices are about as good as they're going to get insofar as cheap prices are to the advantage of the long-term investor.
Well, and you're not just coming up with something off the top of your head. There is a mathematical reason why gold has to go up when you've got so many people shorting the market. You know, when bullish sentiment gets down below, say, 8-9%, we know that there's going to be a turn in the market because, frankly, they just have to go cover the short bets, the bet down on gold. Those paper contracts have to be covered.
Yeah, and so part of it is a sentiment issue, and a part of it is just, you know, how many people have stacked in on the paper side of the trade, pushing the price lower. So there's more shorts today. Those are people who are hoping to benefit from the decline in price. And particularly, this is in the hedge fund community, what we would call the managed money section. If you're looking at the commodity traders report, the COT report, more of those shorts today than there was in December of 2015.
Which was the bottom down at 1050.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So the net position has gone past 42,500 short contracts. And again, it's the paper markets that are driving the price. And there is this strong correlation between the price of gold and the managed money positions. That's a very strong correlation. And they drive the short-term trends because they're using a tremendous amount of leverage. These are temporary bets. This is not a long-term trend. But I think the fascinating fact is that they're always the most committed, either long or short, at exactly the wrong time.
Right.
So you see the biggest short bets when the market is getting ready to head higher. And you see the biggest long bets, that is people who've bought gold with great enthusiasm, vim, and vigor just before the price is getting ready to head lower. And again, I mean, that may sound counterintuitive, but that's just the way it is. I think they'll have a diminished impact on the price as time goes on. But right here, right now, those short positions have certainly driven the price lower. Very small consolation, I know. What makes that a good news story is that you have to buy the asset back to cover that short position. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a lot of pent-up buying just to close out the position. And I think that's just around the corner.
Well, I think it's worth looking back at history just a little bit. I remember, we all remember, April 12th, 2013. That was a huge day down for gold. Gold dropped almost $100 on that Friday. And then that next Monday, tax day, April 15th, 2013, it dropped almost another $100. What had happened was Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch had come in a couple of hours. They had dumped the market on Friday with 400 tons of paper gold contracts. Now, what was interesting about that, and you and I were talking about this the other day, that doesn't represent physical gold, but it forced physical gold selling out of the ETFs, okay? And the ETFs, it came about that we saw about 700 tons of physical gold, because of leverage, forced to sell out of the ETFs. Well, China ended up accumulating about 700 tons of extra gold that was off the record, we found out at the end of the year. What we're seeing this time, Dave, Again, these paper markets, they can control the price to a degree, but the physical selling of actual physical gold, we haven't really had that capitulation. We don't have, as a company right now, hardly anyone selling us gold, and I think that that's probably the case worldwide. Physical gold is not necessarily being sold.
Yeah, so the ounce price is held up pretty well with the quantity of short positions which are in the market, and the shorts do have to cover to right. capture their profits, which we mentioned, but that means that we can, to some degree, count the upside. We can count the next move higher from here, assuming that, as you're suggesting, they don't trigger a stampede of physical liquidations. And we're seeing very little by way of liquidations right now. That's in stark contrast to that market purge of December 2015. But if the physical stampede for the exits were to begin, then you've got the short covering rally, which sort of is offset by that physical stampede, and you'd have sort of a muted move or very little move higher.
Okay, the last time those shorts got to be to this level or close to this level, we had a pretty substantial upturn percentage-wise in the market, gold market.
Yeah, the selling stopped, and the short selling stopped too and reversed course. And the last rally off of the kinds of numbers that we're seeing on the short side of the market, that is the managed money or hedge fund shorts, was about a 30% rally. Mm-hmm. That implies off of these levels a move in the metals price to about $1,550.
That's for gold. How about silver?
If you assume a fairly conservative gold-silver ratio, let's say 65 to 1, maybe $24, $25 silver. So, mm-hmm. I mean, the last run, gold shares moved up 160%.
Yeah, the mining shares really...
Now, that was in less than 6 month period.
Right.
And I think that above 1400 on the gold price, I think those numbers for the miners might be conservative, because your all-in sustainable costs have come down for many of those mining entities, and the space has really, it's been left for dead. So two strong recommendations, and this is consistent from, you know, what we've talked about here in the commentary for the last 12 to 24 months. First of all, I would say don't be afraid of cash. Raise mm-hmm. some cash from your equity portfolios. If you're sitting in index funds or you've been managing your own portfolios in 401ks or whatnot, you want to get as conservative as possible. If you are the do-it-yourselfer, I would even recommend adopting a hedge for those positions, something like what we do on the tactical short. Second, I would offset your financial market risk. I would offset your systemic credit risk. I would offset your currency risk with a healthy allocation to precious metals. So, I mean, again, consistent from us in the last 12 to 24 months has been raise cash and offset any of the risks that may be implicit to that liquidity position with a precious metals position. So gold is your asset for preservation of capital, and silver has more of an enhanced growth profile. So in combination, those two, I think, get a lot done.
You know, there's a general consensus right now when I talk to people out on the street that we are seeing economic growth here in America. But if you really look worldwide, we could experience inflation and shrink in the growth. I mean, there seems to be a liquidity problem worldwide right now. Maybe not in America as we speak, because the dollar's getting a lot of attention. What's your thought?
Well, I think in relative terms, that puts us as the winner to the rest of the world. But the reality is the whole world, in terms of GDP growth and economic activity, tends to move in lockstep anymore. So it's not as if the U.S. can avoid a slowdown if that slowdown is, in fact, materializing everywhere else in the world. It just means that we might respond to a slowdown in global GDP growth on a delayed basis. The folks at Gave Cal Research are assuming a recession in 2019 by no later than March.
Is that in America as well?
I think they're talking global. So I met with Charles Gave in Hong Kong a few years ago, and I regularly read Anatole Kaletsky, the other half of the company. You've got Gave and Cal. That's Gave and Kaletsky. He's regularly featured in the Financial Times, and I don't always agree. With, I'd say about 60% of the time, I don't agree with Kaletsky, but he's a very thoughtful writer. And I think the assumption by their firm is that global liquidity is shrinking right now. And when it reaches a certain threshold, which they expect to hit here shortly, that recession happens within about 6 months' time. So it's all too common to have recession when global liquidity is shrinking. And I would add that in a period of rising inflation, and shrinking global demand with, again, maybe we create a little carve out for the U.S. because we're the ones that are likely to experience that slowdown last. But you're talking about shrinking global demand, rising global inflation. You're talking about global stagflation, and that can't be ruled out. I can't begin to put a price on gold in the scenario where you have global stagflation.
So where you have economic shrink and inflation combined.
That's right. And we've mentioned before, you've got the home builders. They're not giving you any evidence of economic growth and activity here in the United States. Dr. Copper, which is a great leading indicator of economic activity, not just domestically like the home builders might be, but Dr. Copper gives you a much better picture as to economic activity globally. And they seem to be indicating a slowdown on the horizon, not a ramping up of global growth. So, you know, word to the wise, just continue to watch the industrial commodities and continue to watch the emerging markets for indications and signs of global GDP growth or contraction.
Okay, so we have to talk about now the elephant or the ostrich or the turkey in the room. I'm sorry, we have to talk turkey because I think most people see Turkey as a country somewhere in the middle of the European continent, somewhere near Asia, maybe Europe, but it's really inconsequential to the average Joe here in America. Unfortunately, that's not the case. $500 billion says that we could see this global slowdown triggered, talking Turkey.
Well, Kevin, we've had an interest in Turkey for a number of reasons for quite a few years. And, you know, we've reached out to the folks at Stratfor and they've given us some insights into the Justice and Development Party and sort of the return to a religious state. As you know, when Kemal Ataturk took the reins, he moved towards a secular state and there was a radical shift for decades and decades within Turkey. And, you know, on that basis, they might have ultimately been far more compatible being integrated into the European Union. But here in recent years, and certainly under the leadership of Erdogan, you see a move towards more radical Islam, Islamic expression. And the faith is certainly very real. So there's a geopolitical aspect and there's a part of who is going to rule the Middle East and who's going to be the influencer, whether it's Iran or Turkey. You know, that's one of the questions that we've asked for a long time about Turkey.
Well, just a little background, because I think sometimes we have to understand what motivates people before we judge what the next step will be. And for hundreds of years, Turkey, that Ottoman Empire, was the caliphate. That was where Islam was united. That ended in 1918. Okay. Now, Erdogan, if I understand correctly, his belief and a lot of the beliefs of the people there in Turkey is that they are now initiating the next caliphate.
Reestablishing the caliphate in Turkey is sort of at the center of a reemergent Ottoman Empire. So Turkey is here now at the middle of sort of the emerging market concerns, and you've got many in the financial press who've described what's happening in Turkey as highly idiosyncratic and, you know, well contained to just that geography there in Turkey. And I think there's huge problems with that analysis because, first, it remains to be seen just how much the events in Turkey actually do stay in Turkey. And a part of this is hard to know in advance, but will there be a mood impact? Will there be a sentiment impact that shifts sentiment from Turkey to other emerging market countries as people say, hey, wait a minute, this kind of risk that we're seeing emerge in Turkey, it's just as applicable in other countries. In fact, you've got the same balance sheet considerations. You get the same kinds of weaknesses elsewhere. And so you could see that sentiment shift occur.
Let's talk about that sentiment shifting. And you talked about balance sheet similarities. Well, the balance sheet similarity is what you've called the original sin. And that is, if you're going to borrow money, make sure you can print your way out of the hole. I mean, that's what America's done. That's not the original sin. That's just getting away with murder. The original sin is to go borrow money in somebody else's currency. If that currency increases, what you have to pay back increases.
Well, and this is where you see the political posturing by Erdogan is very convenient. Contrary to Erdogan's claims that this is a Western assault on his country and that we're trying to take him down, the issue at their core, this the most basic, is that they've been building instability within the credit markets for the past decade. And you're right, this goes back to what we described weeks ago as relating to the original sin. Much of the debt that Turkish corporations took on was on better terms, in other words, they got lower interest rates than they could get locally.
From Germany or America or you name it.
Yeah, but it was denominated in U.S. dollars, or it was denominated, instead of in lira, it was denominated in euros. Mm-hmm. So that takes away the ability to default, frankly, the way most governments do, which is sort of the, you know, you just print your way to nirvana, and you make the debt burden go away by inflating it away. You devalue your currency and inflate away the debt burden. That's not an option. That's not an option when your debts are denominated in someone else's currency. And that's the mistake they've been making over the last decade, right? And the BIS has followed this very closely. They've seen the instability. And again, so this is, Erdogan can claim that this is us attacking him. What it is a growing audience of investors saying, wait a minute, we've got issues and it's no longer on the horizon. It's in the here and now.
Oftentimes you've brought up that we've got people right now investing in Spain or Italy for that extra half of 1%, you know, just a little bit extra. But Turkey, same type of thing. You've got money that's come into Turkey from the outside because of a little bit of a better rate. That would be called hot money if you were a bank. Hot money means that if you're not getting the better rate or if there's a danger, it just all flows right back out the other direction.
Part of the conversation we have almost every day with clients is, you know, if you have excess reserves, personal reserves sitting in a bank, you should know how stable the institution is. And one of the things that makes an institution like a bank stable or unstable is the reason why people are there, right? So if people are there only for the yield, it means that if that one variable changes, all that money is gone.
It's called the hot money index when you're doing bank analysis.
That's right. So it's a measure of the loyalty of your client base. And it's also a measure of the potential instability for your bank deposits, because you borrow short and lend long, you need to know that not everybody's going to ask for their money back at once, or you have the equivalent of a bank run, right? Because if you've lent everybody's money out, then you don't have access to it. And that's the issue with a country like Turkey, where you have people coming in, these hot money flows come into the country, foreign direct investment that is seeking higher yields. But then when the equation changes, you have foreign investors who are no longer so inspired to be there. So you've got Erdogan, who has not been very helpful in recent months. He's made these sort of Chavez-style pronouncements.
Right. It is feeling like Venezuela in a way, isn't it?
What do foreign investors do? How do they respond? It really has put them on notice. And so the hot money flows during the past 10 years, they've moved to Turkey in part because, I mean, look, the economic growth rate in Turkey has averaged something close to China's, between 6 and 7% annual growth over the last 10 to 15 years. And the returns have been more generous. Mm. But to listen to one of the many strongman leaders on the scene today, you know, if you listen to him, again, you could almost, if you could just take away the accent, you wouldn't know who's speaking, Erdogan or Chavez.
Well, and I think about Will Rogers, okay, because Will Rogers was famous for saying, I'd rather have a return of my capital than worry about the return on my capital. And at some point, there's a shift.
Right. So from Chavez to Maduro, it doesn't matter who's in office today. It's the same language, and investors are appreciating that more and more. Their money is in a place where there is no constitutional safeguards for the return of capital.
Right.
So return on, you're right, becomes a fixation of return of capital, and it focuses investors' attention. How do I get my money back? Now, this is a totally different way of approaching things, because up to this point, they've been willing to ignore risk attributes and just look at potential returns.
Well, we're only talking about past debt. Erdogan just got elected again with an awful lot of future promises.
So this layers in a fiscal concern, right? Because you've got budget deficits and fiscal mismanagement, which, again, when you come into office and you're like, look, I'm going to promise you the sun, moon, and stars, not only do you have debt, going back to the original sin, that issue, then you've got hot money flows, which are part of the reason they're uninspired to remain, is, yes, currency fluctuation. But also, you look at the budget deficits, which should blow out in the next 12 to 18 months on the basis of Erdogan's promises. This is just one more layer. Budget deficits, fiscal mismanagement, currency chaos. And then you've got new debts which are going to be required, added to the old ones, the need to either roll over or refinance those existing debts. And here's where it becomes really critical over the next 12 to 24 months. You've got ABN and AMRO combines the funds, which are required to maintain foreign debt obligations. That's one element. Combine that with the current account deficit, and they arrive at an annual external financing requirement. Keep in mind, this is annual. External financing requirement of $218 billion. Hmm. So Turkey's between a rock and a hard place. It's always fascinating to me, if you think about how investors approach the markets, they tend to ignore maturity schedules. You can see this with corporations today, too. I mean, like, if you looked at the amount of debts that recently we were picking on Time Warner, and so you've got another merger, and they've got hundreds of billions of dollars in debt. Well, more important than the quantity is the schedule for payback.
Yeah. Because when do you owe me that money?
That's right. You need to figure out where the pig in the python is, because at some point, you're going to have more acute problems given the amount of money that has to be financed at a point in time. So again, it fascinates me that those maturity schedules get set aside.
Well, let's just look at the United States. Okay, over the next 5 years, how much of our U.S. debt has to be refinanced or repaid? What is that?
So if we say that the average maturity for all of our debt is 5 years, then here's a rough estimate. I mean, this is not precise, but a rough estimate is that we've got to pay off 20% of all of our debts each year over the next 5 years. It's not exactly accurate because we've got some that's financed longer term. But on average, we've got to refinance 20%. The reaction of the bond market here in the U.S. is likely to be a little bit more agitated in future years.
Higher interest rates?
Yeah, I think the bond investor is going to require higher rates to compensate for inflation and other factors. And, you know, when you think about this just from the standpoint of cash flow, it's going to cost government more. This is irksome if you're managing a budget, because rates that you're going to be paying in the future are not likely to be the low to zero rates of the recent past. So already we have our interest expense, which is the fastest growing government expenditure. It's not quite 8%, 7.4% of all of our expenses, and it's an even higher number as a percentage of total revenue.
Well, and we're looking at higher and higher interest rates here in America. I mean, the expectation in Wall Street right now is that they're going to continue to raise rates.
Yeah. Now, I mean, a part of the reason why that number continues to grow as a percentage of total revenues down, which is due to corporate tax breaks and whatnot. Mm. But you're right. You check in with the folks there at JP Morgan, and Jamie Dimon would say, hey, look, we should already be at 4% on the 10-year. So 100 basis points, a full 1% higher than we are now. And he says, but you should be ready for the 10-year to be at 5% or higher. That there are huge implications from that. Go ahead and tack on an extra 2 points if you're financing a mortgage. So if the 10-year is at 5, you can count on a 30-year fixed rate mortgage north of 7. Now, what does that do to the price of housing? You begin to see this relationship that we've described as a seesaw, where as interest rates increase, the other end of the seesaw, which is pricing, has to come down. We've had an era where rates have been rock bottom and prices have been sky high, and there is that opposite natural relationship. As rates rise, prices have to fall. And frankly, it's not just in real estate, right? It's also in bonds and stocks too. As your hurdle rate for stocks, if you're doing discounted cash flow models, then you know that as interest rates rise, you have to see a recalibration in price. Nobody thinks in these terms, but it's coming anyways.
Let's go ahead and flip back to internationally, though, because the emerging markets could be like a contagious disease as their debt starts to fail. We're talking about the United States, but we're no longer in a bubble. I think of one of the great authors, one of the greatest books that we've probably read on the markets was Anatomy of the Bear by Russell Napier. And you went out to Scotland to spend some time with him. Interesting guy. But he's also looking at these emerging markets, and he's saying, guys, you better be paying attention to what's outside the door. Don't just look at what's in the house. Look outside the door, because it's coming.
Right. Smithers, Napier, a number of people taught a class on financial market history at the business school there at the University of Edinburgh, and it's fantastic. I'm glad that I did spend some time out there. The issue of contagion, it's not merely one of sentiment affecting the emerging market countries. It's not sort of, you know, are we going to see broad-based selling of an index which contains a whole smorgasbord of smaller economic players? The bigger issue is that contagion in this case, when we're talking about Turkey, is it ties right back into Europe. You're talking about the bank exposure in Europe, which is substantial. And so go back to our commentary with Russell Napier, say 2 years ago, and that was what we were talking about. The issue has been cooking for a while. This is long before Trump. This is not about Trump picking on Erdogan. Again, you've had balance sheet issues and imbalances which have been brewing for a little time now.
Let me ask you a question then, because one of the things that's fascinating to me the last 31 years that I've been here is when we have a stock market crash, gold initially goes down because it's the most liquid item that people can sell to keep whatever position that they're going with. And now, of course, gold immediately recovers after a stock market crash, but initially, especially the first few days, maybe the first week, it goes down. Now, when Turkey is about to go down, strangely enough, they're also having to sell gold to cover commitments.
Yeah, this is defending normal, right? So, I mean, this is where, if you look at the financial crisis 1998, Putin was wise to look back and say, look, I understand what was nearly the demise of our country when Russia was forced to default. And what he did up to 2008 and 2009 was set aside about $600 billion in cash. And the Russians were able to get through the financial crisis because they had liquidity.
They had savings.
Now, they have liquidity in a variety of forms. So do the Turks. And when you look at the Turkish government, they were sitting on what for them was a record, I think over 500, maybe 550 tons of gold at the end of last year. Now, they've whittled that down to about 200 tons. They've had to liquidate quite a bit of it and use it to defend the lira from further decline. So year to date, their cachet of gold has been cut more than in half. And again, if the reports that I've seen are accurate, that started from over 500 tons. It's a very interesting thing. I mean, there are other reasons we have weakness in the gold price, which we've already mentioned, the short selling in the paper markets. Trust me, these quantities of gold coming to market certainly don't push the price higher. That's a lot. A couple hundred tons coming to market in a short period of time certainly does enhance the pressure on the downside.
And I talked about it being the elephant in the room, or the ostrich, or the turkey. Okay, a little play on words here, but what we could be witnessing, according to Napier, is the largest default in financial history if this happens.
And it's bigger than the 08-09 Lehman moment.
That's hard to believe.
We're all too familiar with that. But, you know, de facto, this becomes a default when and if the Turks announce, or Erdogan, or anyone who manages their financial markets, announces capital controls. When they announce capital controls, then you have a de facto default on close to $500 billion in liabilities. Mm. And here are the considerations you've got to keep in mind. Because again, we're not talking about just a sell-off in indexes that represent emerging markets. You're talking about direct implications into the banking system within Europe. And that becomes very contagious, not just in the setting of emerging markets, but in any financial sphere.
And he's motivated by other things, too. We talked about this caliphate, but he does not like Trump. So whatever Trump is going to try to force on this issue, he'll probably fight back.
Right. So your two issues are number one, you've got $500 billion, which is your total liability, which is at risk. And the second thing is that contrary to past periods of economic crisis in Turkey, you can go back to 1994, they had a significant lira collapse, and then in 2001 as well. This is different this time. Erdogan is not likely to beg for money from a Washington-based franchise. I'm coming into the office this morning and I'm listening to NPR and they've got somebody on from the Peterson Institute and they're saying, well, it's not a big deal. They just go to the IMF. I don't think Erdogan is going to go to the IMF. The IMF is a Washington-based franchise. And again, he's not going to beg Washington for money after having positioned the problem the way he has. You know, so again, what that implies is that he's not going to be extending terms or renegotiating loans as you'd ordinarily see in a default scenario. Mm-hmm. What happens when a country defaults is that the creditors usually get some of their money back. Everything's renegotiated. The normal means by which creditors are ultimately made whole or partially whole is that you just massage the terms. So let's
say ego's a factor in this case.
You had 10-year terms on the debt. Now it's 30 years. And maybe the interest rate was 4% and now it's 3%. So the terms get easier so that it eases up on cash flow. But The significant difference, I think, is you've got ego butting up against ego.
Mm-hmm.
And when ego is butting up against ego, Erdogan has made it clear from his perspective that Trump and the West are attempting to undermine this reemergent Ottoman Empire. And he's already gone to the Turkish people and said, it's your patriotic zeal, it's your personal sacrifice, it's your direct appeals to Allah, which will allow for the Turkish people to get through this. And again, that doesn't sound like positioning for a quick pivot to foreign aid from the IMF. It just doesn't have that feel to it. That may change, but...
Well, something that's making the world very, very different for all of us right now is that China is on the rise. You almost have two worlds going on right now. You've got the Asian world and you've got the Western world. China's talking about their currency becoming more and more valid as far as a reserve currency. You've got bank loans coming in from China. You've got this one belt, one road push. I'm just wondering, Dave, if Erdogan needs money, is China where he goes?
You know, some people would say that Goldman is always doing quote unquote God's work and, you know, out there sort of saving people when they need money and whatnot. The PBOC is, you could say, is doing God's work as well. And maybe that's what Erdogan is talking about when he's talking about praying to Allah. Allah may deliver, but the earthly source of salvation may be via the People's Bank of China. And I think it'd be an interesting historical plot twist, because here in recent years, you got the Asian Development Bank, which has been put in motion to directly compete with the World Bank. And what they want to do is basically, using soft power influence, come in and fund infrastructure projects and create good feelings, create goodwill towards China and the other members of the Asian Development Bank, and replace that goodwill, which in the past has been extended to the West and the World Bank. Now we can imagine also a substitute for the IMF and the availability of liquidity coming from China. What would that do in this scenario? I think it would send a very clear message to the rest of the world that the West is not the only franchise in town. And if help is what you need, then what you should first do is compare terms, right? Because the Eastern requirements are going to be far less restrictive. Certainly when it comes to human rights and pro-democracy requirements as sort of a quid pro quo, that's always been the case. The IMF has this laundry list of you will do this and this and this and this, and on those conditions, we will give you some money. What if China comes in and says, we're not interested in getting involved in telling you how to live your life? We're not going to tell you how to treat your people. We're just going to tell you that we're here to be your friend, and here's a very reasonable loan, and we'll make it work for you. So again, I mean, what we're doing is creating a space where the Chinese can come in. That's a possibility I think we need to watch for.
Well, and they haven't been publicly positioned in the minds of the Turkish people or the Europeans as the bad guys. You know, you think about the loan sharks that the West is perceived as, especially the way Erdogan talks about that. China can almost come in as the cowboy on the white horse with the white hat and say, you know what, you guys need help, we'll save you. These loan sharks are trying to take advantage of you, but not us.
Napier's recent comments, I think, were fantastic. One of the things that he points out is that we have a whole community within the financial universe, and they analyze things according to spreadsheets and calculus, and it's fairly historically ignorant. He goes on to say, having the ability to pay does not translate into a willingness to pay. Even if the Turks could pay off $500 billion worth of loans, doesn't mean they will. And this is again where your spreadsheet says, oh, but they're a good credit risk. And the reality and the historical context and the motivation to pay doesn't always translate into payment. And particularly, I think you use the right words, particularly if you view the institutions as loan sharks, right? And that's what they would view the IMF as, is loan sharks enslaving the Ottoman Empire. Who wants that? That is not the kind of image that Erdogan wants to portray in the Middle East, right? We have a destabilized Middle East and a competition for who is going to be the dominant player and who, you know, other countries are going to gravitate towards leadership. This is not the time and the place for Erdogan to say, yes, but I do need that extra money from the IMF.
If I'm a European bank, though, who's at risk right now? Okay, what European banks should be looking, you know, twice in the rearview mirror?
This is where I think you could see European banks take a hit, which is on par with what they saw, the kinds of chaos they saw during the global financial crisis. You've got UniCredit, you've got ING, you've got Deutsche Bank, you've got Commerzbank, so a couple there from Germany, BBVA, BNP Paribas from Paris and France, and there's a few others that are massively exposed. But the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, follows cross-border banking exposure. That's the category that they put it in. And they count $148 billion in U.S. dollar exposure. Again, this is cross-border banking exposure. The Turkish corporations and banks owe $148 billion in U.S. dollars and another $110 billion in euros. And that's euro-denominated exposure. Spanish banks have loaned out $83 billion, which, again, we talk about original sin. Here's what it looks like. If $83 billion was sitting at an exchange rate of 4-1, you're talking about an original loan, U.S. dollars, $83 billion, translated into liras, $332 billion, right? Now, as the exchange rate is deteriorated, you go from owing 332 billion lira. On the other side of exchange rate deterioration, you now have 600 billion lira.
So that debt was doubled, almost doubled.
Right. And so this is why that whole issue of the original sin is such a big deal, because very quickly with exchange rate deterioration, the burden of debt becomes so unbearable that you say, look, I'm collecting revenue in lira. There is no way that my revenue is doubling such that I can keep up with these lira payments. No way. So you get the Spanish banks, $83 billion in loans to Turkish corporations. French banks are owed currently $38.4 billion. Italian banks a little bit less, $17 billion. In total, over the next 12 months, you've got $51 billion scheduled for repayment. Now, of course, they can refinance that, but on what terms? What's the interest rate going to be? Is anyone going to want to redenominate to Turkish lira? I don't think so.
I'd like you to talk a little bit more about capital controls, because that's something that here in America, we don't think much about, but that's one method of default that is devastating once that occurs.
Yeah, well, and there's a difference between sort of a regime which has been in place for a long period of time and sort of the imposition of capital controls in short order. If you go back to the 1990s, all we had in Europe was capital controls. There was no free movement of capital between one country and another. It came at a very, very high cost and with strict limitations. Those capital controls went away by the mid-90s, and the free flow of capital started to bring about a huge resurgence of economic activity and business activity on a cross-border basis. Now, what we're talking about is the possibility of going back to capital controls where there's a limitation in the amount of money that you can take out of a country. We go back to that issue of hot money, and this is where it gets very important.
You become captive.
Yeah. The money that's there has to stay there. And it doesn't matter if it was foreign direct investment, which is now locked up inside the country, but also domestic currency holdings are not allowed to leave, because you end up gutting the economy if all the liquidity leaves.
As people are slinging back and forth these tariffs, it seems like it's building more of a nationalistic type of mentality anyway. I mean, capital controls would almost be an obvious outcome of a currency war or a tariff war.
Right. So we've got tariffs, that conversation's in the air. We've got the themes of more nationalistic driven trade competition. Who's going to keep a larger slice of the global GDP pie? And I think these are significant marks of deglobalization. But probably the most significant mark of deglobalization is the possibility of capital controls. And, you know, reading a Financial Times article and one particular analyst saying, well, of course, this is what they have to do. The Turkish government has to impose capital controls immediately. And there's implications to that. We've already seen the Chinese ratchet up restrictions on outbound monies. They don't want to see money leaving the country. They put limitations. And if money is leaving the country, it's doing so on an illegal basis, right? Now you have the Turkish people looking at a similar scenario. Close the exits before any more vital liquidity can move out. And that's the real key, is an economy has to have a certain amount of liquidity in it to keep on moving. It's sort of the grease in the gears. And if you take away the liquidity, the gears come to a grinding halt.
Right. So a liquidity crisis ultimately leads to somebody not paying their debt, to solvency.
There we go. So that's the sequence we've mentioned over and over again. Liquidity crisis often precedes solvency crisis. And capital controls are an attempt to stem the tide of liquidity exit. They implicitly shut off payments to external creditors. That's where you end up with the de facto default there in Turkey. So far more concerning, this is, again, you can ignore the conversation on tariffs because it may happen, it may not, and we don't know what all of the economic ramifications are going to be. You can ignore stock market volatility because it may happen, it may not, and we may have central banks step in and save the day, and we've gotten used to that. So financial markets don't really care about the possibility of stock market volatility or the conversation about tariffs. What they do care about is a radical shift in liquidity. The concern about stock market volatility, set that aside, it really is more about a shift in liquidity, a radical shift in liquidity. And if you imagine the liquidity being like, you know, again, the game of musical chairs, it's there and the music's playing and no one cares. When the music stops, you've got the mass movement to lock down a seat, and that happens in an instant. So people are not focused on liquidity, and then all of a sudden that's the only thing that they're focused on. And in one moment, the players are listening to the music, enjoying it, and the next moment, their fixation is only on the real estate they're scrambling for. Not everyone's going to get a seat, and you got to make sure that you get yours.
I can remember a few incidents in the past where we've seen flight capital that really boosted the value of the dollar because somebody was fleeing or trying to get their money out of the country. The same thing. It's interesting when you have flight capital going into the dollar, oftentimes it's also going into gold. And it's one of those occasions where you see the dollar and gold rising at the same time, oftentimes. Do you think with the potential of capital controls, as that liquidity tightens, you'll see a lot of that go into the dollar?
Yeah, I think you'll see a lot of it go into the dollar. I don't know how much will go into gold. I think the long-term story for gold hasn't changed at all. But the short-term story for the dollar could be up, up, and away. In a highly leveraged world, what you have with the events in Turkey become extra critical because liquidity is getting scarce in a particular country. And that may translate to liquidity getting scarce in Europe. And then sort of in a daisy chain manner, that may very well translate into a scramble for U.S. dollar liquidity on a global basis. So you remember that what we've achieved in the last 20, 30 years, our primary export has been U.S. dollar denominated credit. And so for all the debt that we've pumped into the world denominated in U.S. dollars, it requires dollar liquidity for payment. Mm-hmm. Before we move too far away from Turkey's past in their economic crisis, I mentioned 1994 earlier, but I think it's worth noting that the backdrop issue in 1994 was the hike in rates here in the United States, right? So we set off chaos. Whether you're talking about Orange County, California, or Ankara, we set off global chaos by an interest rate increase cycle.
So we were the trigger event, even though they had the weakness already built in. We were the trigger.
That's correct. So we're the trigger event. We create something that tightens global finance. And I'll tell you what, global finance is even more interconnected today than it was in the early 90s. So again, it's our normalization of rates, which has a huge ripple effect, both in the spheres of interest rates, but also in the spheres of currency values. So emerging markets, that's where all of a sudden you factor in, we've seen some pain in the emerging markets. We've seen some underperformance, whether it's actually moving into bear market territory, if you're talking about the Shenzhen and Shanghai exchanges. But emerging markets are nowhere done experiencing pain. God forbid we see a runaway dollar market where the US dollar spikes to 110 or 120, you know, on global financial market deterioration, because what would happen on the other side of the equation is emerging market carnage. As the dollar moved higher, that would be a cruciform for every emerging market currency. The dollar moving to those levels would be a hallmark of the greatest global depression in history. I don't see the dollar going that high, but I certainly do see a reasonable possibility of it getting to the 102 area from the current mid-90s where it is today.
Okay, but Europe. Europe has already experienced an awful lot of potential default in various countries. You know, we saw Greece, we saw Cyprus. Is Europe in a position to swallow tens, if not hundreds of billions in losses?
No way. No way. I mean, I think the U.S. banks, frankly, are more adequately capitalized at this point and could take a significant hit, but we're not the ones with the exposure, tens of billions of dollars exposure to Turkey. So I think those banks now have to consider with a fresh perspective that the cross-border loans, which they made, and they made with adequate collateral, Now, all of a sudden, they're in a position where it's going to be very, very difficult for them to gain access to that collateral, right? So the beauty of a loan is that you've got an asset generally which backs it. Except that when you do a loan on a cross-border basis, you bring in a political and even a geopolitical element where Erdogan may say and may position it such that it's almost impossible for the foreign lender to get access to that collateral. So, you know, you looked at the loan and you said, well, it's adequately collateralized. But what if in a day, all of a sudden you have no access to the collateral whatsoever? It changes the equation completely. The quality of the loan has to be significantly discounted. Maybe even it's marked to zero. I think this gets very, very interesting because Europe was already in a hard place. Turkey underscores just how difficult it is to manage in mass for many countries, both at a monetary and a fiscal level. And it's not telling us anything we didn't already know. It's just drawing out what the issues are.
Oftentimes, the map is reorganized. After World War II, we saw the map redrawn. You know, after World War I, the map was redrawn. We could go back to the 1870s and look at Europe. The map was redrawn. But, you know, the map for the last 60 years or so, since the end of World War II, has really been Western banking giving all the loans. Now, we talked a little bit earlier about two worlds now are emerging. We almost have the Axis and the Allies. I don't want to necessarily say they're the enemy, but you have China. China, in a way, could help redraw the map. I'm not talking just Turkey. I'm talking also Germany and some of the other players.
Yeah, and I think they do factor in a large way. If you think of the pressure the U.S. is creating globally and the realignment which is possible in this period of pressure, certainly there is no stretching the imagination to see Iran and Turkey and Russia all shift closer to China. Mm-hmm. And in recent days, we've actually had the Germans protest our U.S.-Iranian sanctions. And they've been indicating that they're not going to comply with the U.S. unilateral dictates. And what does that mean exactly? It means that they may continue to do business with Iran. And that gives us an excuse, at least as we've postured, we will not be doing business at all with any country that is working with Iran. So now it further orients the Germans towards a new economic bloc as well.
Well, not to mention, I mean, they get half their oil from Russia. So there are ties.
Yeah, huge ties that already exist there. And remember that Turkey, and this is what's weird, Turkey is a longtime U.S. ally. Everything that we've done in the Middle East in the last 10 to 15 years has required or involved Turkish involvement. They're also a NATO member, right? So here we are in the process of undoing a pretty pivotal NATO member.
Sure.
And the question is, are we rekindling old alliances?
Well, Kamran Bakari is the one who told us that there was a void, there was a gap created when we took out Saddam Hussein and created that gap in Iraq. You had Iran on one side and you had Turkey on the other. And it was critical. One of those two was going to fill that void. This is the redrawing of the map. This is a long-term redrawing of the map, is it not?
Right. You're talking about politics on the one hand in terms of redrawing of the map and perhaps the redefinition of a modern-day caliphate. But the other issue is financing and who provides financing for a fledgling caliphate. And perhaps it is sort of, again, this next phase of globalization, like the recent phase of capitalism, which we've had, takes on decidedly Chinese characteristics, right? So we've talked about capitalism with Chinese characteristics. Maybe it's globalization 2.0 with Chinese characteristics this time around as well. What does that mean exactly? It's the Sino-centric command and control dynamics, which are written all over it. On a side note, here in the last couple of days, you've had the Italians, which are feverishly demanding that the ECB guarantees bond spreads, or they're going to dismantle the euro.
So that's fixing the price. I mean, there is no free market. At that point, you're just guaranteeing, talk about artificial interest rates.
Yeah, that's right. So you fix the price and cover the market cost of doing so, or we leave. That's basically what the Italians are saying. And that is a direct request for essentially command and control dynamics. It is a request for the death of free markets. It's fascinating. To guarantee a spread between two fixed income assets is to eliminate differentiation.
Right. You take the risk equation out.
Well, right. But you and I need to be able to measure risk and know the difference between loaning money to an Italian versus loaning money to a German. Or the Italian government or the German government or a German bank or an Italian bank. Is there a difference? You're going to see it in the spread between those two things. And the Italians are basically saying you need to guarantee that the spread is the spread and it doesn't move. That kills a market. And what does it do? It introduces that command and control dynamic. To me, that has the specter of the 1940s written all over it, which is a period of time where private capital went very, very private. In other words, it went underground.
Can we just assume that China can come in and do this, though? I mean, their GDP, they have to have very, very strong growth numbers just to keep up with what they need with the debt that they've put out. I mean, their debt to GDP ratio is enormous at this point, even before all this happens.
Still growing. 171% is where it was prior to the global financial crisis, and now it's close to 299%. And their corporate sector is the world's most indebted, yet they control the markets, sort of. You know, I mean, we say they control the markets and they assume that they control the markets. And yet you've got, as we mentioned a moment ago, Shanghai and Shenzhen, those stock markets now in bear market territory. Are they really in control of those markets when they've sold off precipitously, better than 20% in a fairly short period of time? This is where, I think there's a difference between what we pretend to be the result from command and control dynamics and what the actual results are. There is a difference.
Speaking of a change in the map, one of the things that we've always been able to count on, at least the last three or four decades, is that the Chinese currency is tied to the U.S. dollar. Now, independence, if China is trying to exercise some independence and express themselves in a different way, they would disconnect from the dollar. Aren't we getting signs of that right now?
Yeah, that's right. So again, the conversation about tariffs, everybody is talking about it. You get trade conflict. It not only captures the headlines, but if you look at the PhD economists globally, they continue to ulcerate over these issues of trade conflict and tariffs. But the real big change is in the currency world. And Napier pointed out in his most recent research piece that the U.S. dollar renminbi exchange rate, which for 20 years has been hyper-managed in order to deliver a particular economic outcome to the benefit of the Chinese, it now appears that that exchange rate target has vanished.
Taking away the predictability that we've had.
Right. And this is a topic that we're going to explore fully with Russell on the program later this fall. But there are massive implications stemming from a monetary regime change. But that's exactly what we have, is one of the key elements in what we've done, our trade relationship with China. It has changed, and the change in large part was forced by what the Trump administration has set in motion and how the Chinese have looked at the implications of the evolving landscape and want to position themselves somewhat to insulate themselves from a further decline in the emerging markets. But I'll tell you what, in a world of chaos defined by increased capital controls, defined by debt repudiation, which we're talking about in Turkey, defined by counterparty claims, which exist, but nobody really cares about until the moment of crisis where you have to double check and make sure that you have access to your capital and can actually get a hold of your collateral, get a hold of your capital.
It sounds like the music is still playing, but is ready to stop.
It's like too many dancers seeking too few chairs. To me, gold makes an enormous amount of sense. Price be damned. I don't care if the price goes up or down in the next 2 weeks. It's a real financial asset. It is outside of the financial system. And I tell you what, those merits are going to add premium in time.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. And you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.